Welcome to Subject Object Verb, presented by Art Review. I'm your host, Ross Simonini. I discovered the Book of Dead Philosophers, written by Simon Critchley, about 10 years ago, and I've read it twice more since then. It's one of those very rare portals into philosophy that doesn't treat the reader either as an academic by dropping all sorts of arcane references, or as an oblivious child who's just starting to think about thinking. It was nice, simple, clear, generous writing about philosophy. And even more importantly, it allowed me to apply ideas to my daily life, which was once, way back in ancient Greece, the whole point of philosophy. For me and many others, Critchley has become one of the leading guides for philosophy in the 21st century. He's able to dance between the ancients and contemporaries, between the abstract and concrete, between pop culture and the esoteric. And he started writing his philosophy column, The Stone, for the New York Times in 2010 as a way of spreading philosophy to a broader audience. He refers to it as one of the great adventures in his life. And his newest book, Bald, is many of these columns from the last decade on topics like Mormonism, the New Age movement, Philip K. Dick, soccer, and music. What you're hearing right now are Byzantine chants from a monastery perched high on the holy mountain of Athos in Greece. Critchley visited this order of monks for 3 ecstatic days, which he writes about in the book. For him, these recordings don't even begin to get close to how the music felt in the church. A full section of this book is dedicated to religious thought. I've always appreciated how Critchley balances his rational mind with an interest in the phenomenon of belief. He allows the contradictions of faith and criticism and theology and reason to all exist in the same space, as they do in our society. And he presents them all as a part of the fluid history of human thought. Critchley recently taught a course on what he called pandemic mysticism at the New School, where he's a professor. We started exchanging emails about mysticism, sending links back and forth, and he sent me a syllabus for the class, which includes discussions of Ann Carson, Freud, Heidegger, David Bowie, and Krautrock. So I asked him for a short lecture on the topic for the show, something that might bring together his ideas. Lucky for us, he already had something prepared.
Pandemic mysticism. In the wake of COVID-19, many of us have grown used to being hermits, socially distanced and advancing masked against a contaminated and untrustworthy reality defined by pestilence, suffering, and death. In a world of contagion, possibly being contagious ourselves, we have followed a practice that the ancients called anachoresis, or withdrawal into solitude, a retreat from the world. Whether we liked it or not, we all became anchorites or anchoresses. There is a strange asceticism to the world of lockdown and disease, which opened us up to extreme experiences of doubt, dereliction, dreams, hypochondria, hallucination, and a desperate desire for love or a connection with something or someone outside or larger than the self. These experiences and emotions have profound historical and religious echoes with the logic, poetics, and practices of mysticism. It is as if something elemental and primeval has been revived during the pandemic. It seems to me, then, that the pandemic is a good moment to think about the nature of mystical experience. And that's what I'm going to try and do in this little talk. I think I'm temperamentally a mystic. I feel very drawn to this form of experience and this mode of conceptualizing, and in particular, the deepening and layering of concepts with experience and experience with concepts that can be seen in mystical traditions. Because skepticism is not an instinctual or default response for me. If someone tells me something, I'm inclined to believe it, no matter how strange it sounds. Maybe I'm just gullible, particularly when it comes to profound experiences that I've never had, or never really had in the way that I would like. Maybe I'm just a bad philosopher. The thought has certainly crossed my mind. For example, I believe that Julian of Norwich had shewings or revelations of Christ, that George Fox, founder of the Quakers, was carried up to heaven, that William Blake was visited by angels in his dark little dwelling off the Strand in London, that Wordsworth had a total sensuous apprehension of the divine in nature during his ascent of Mount Snowdon, and that Philip K. Dick had an intellectual intuition of the divine in February 1974. This list could be continued. In fact, it could be nicely endless. I don't doubt these things, at least not at first, and I sometimes wonder whether I, as someone who teaches philosophy as a day job, should always be cultivating skepticism or praising the power of critical thinking. There is a defensive myopia to the obsession with critique, a refusal to see what you can't make sense of. At this point in history, it's at least arguable that understanding is as important as critique, and patient, kind-hearted, sympathetic observation more helpful than endless personal opinions, as we live in a world entirely saturated by suspicion and fueled by vicious judgment of each other. I'm not arguing for dogmatism, but I sometimes wonder whether philosophy's obsession with critique risks becoming a form of obsessional self-protection against strange and novel forms of experience. Evelyn Underhill, who did so much to popularize mysticism in the early 20th century, defines it as experience in its most intense form. Mysticism is not primarily a theoretical issue. It is experiential and practical. It is, and this can serve as a sort of definition, it is the cultivation of practices which allow you to free yourselves from your standard habits, your usual fancies and imaginings, and see what is there and stand with what is there. It is the possibility of something like ecstasy. Ecstasy not as an altered state, but as this state, intensified, elevated, deepened. I'm powerfully drawn to the way mystics experience what they experience, and then think, speak, and write about that experience. But it can be quite hard to describe, particularly to skeptical eyes who might see mystics as simply crazy, which in a way they are, mad with God. So I've decided to organize this talk around seven adverbs. Seven adverbs that describe what mysticism might be. For, as the old saying goes, God loveth adverbs. So here goes. Mystics think in the following seven adverbial ways. Obliquely, autobiographically, vernacularly, performatively, practically, erotically, and aesthetically. Obliquely, autobiographically, vernacularly, performatively, practically, erotically, and aesthetically. So adverb one, obliquely. That is to say, enigmatically, negatively, through unsaying, oxymorons, antitheses, exaggerations, and subtractions. Dionysius, writing around the year 500, progenitor of apophatic or negative theology, writes excessively of super-essential darkness or darkness beyond radiance to describe God. The anonymous but Dionysius-inspired and Dionysius-translating author of The Cloud of Unknowing writes, "Of God himself can no man think." The Cloud author's English translation of the mystical theology of Dionysius is simply and beautifully called Hid Divinity. Hid divinity. If God is hidden, then God has to be approached obliquely, negatively. It's the indirection of much mystical writing that interests me. Maybe indirection is the best direction to take in writing. What we can see in so many mystical texts, to borrow from my friend Eugene Thacker, is a logic and a poetics. This is a logic of saying and not saying, a non-negative negation, or a series of what we might call ascending negations, which is a way of approaching or adumbrating what St. John Chrysostom calls the incomprehensibility of God, or the cloud of unknowing that separates us from the divine. Mystical logic with respect to God is not a series of descending affirmations from some postulation of God or substance down through some purported chain of being from angels to humans, animals, and stones. Mystical logic is rather a series of ascending negations, moving up from here below obliquely and superlatively, putting a cloud of forgetting between us and all creatures and peering up through a cloud of unknowing. This logic of negation is also a poetics, which places emphasis on a series of figures like darkness, the desert, cloud, sea, shadow, abyss, radiance, and the whole palette of colours that can be seen in my favourite mystic, Julian of Norwich, from the late 14th century. Here, the intellectual insight into God is conceived on analogy with empirical sight. It is the multiplying of vision from the perceptual to the conceptual. What is particularly interesting are the climatological motifs in the poetics of mysticism. There is a conceptual environmentalism within mysticism. But this is not merely or simply empirical, but also conceptual, where concepts endlessly enrich and enliven experience. Adverb 2, autobiographically. The birth of autobiography, especially female autobiography, occurs with mystical writing. The I in Julian of Norwich is the first I of an Englishwoman. The second is Marjorie Kemp, a generation later than Julian. They met in 1415. Marjorie wanted to consult Dame Julian, as she called her. The earliest women's lives we have are in many cases the lives of the mystics. Sometimes these lives will be written directly by the mystic, as with Julian, Marguerite Porrette, or Teresa of Avila. Sometimes they'll be recorded by Brother Scribe, as with Angela of Foligno, Christina of Marchiate, Christine the Astonishing, and many, many others. This autobiographical tradition begins a lot earlier and in a different mode with St. Augustine, where Augustine and his mother, Santa Monica, have a fleeting vision and reach out and touch what they see as the eternal wisdom of the Lord. This is the vision at Ostia in Book 9 of the Confessions. Importantly, if there is the discovery of an I in mystical writing, then it is I as another, as Rambo said, I as another. The I finds its voice and itself through its relation to the otherness of God. Maybe this is why autobiographies without God are so dull. The tyranny of memoir, so dull unless they stage autobiography as the self's conflictual, dialectical relation to itself. The division within the self that still inhabits the form of religious narrative. I think here of Rousseau's Confessions, or even more extremely, Rousseau, Judge of Jean-Jacques, or again Nietzsche's stunning self-presentation in his 1886 prefaces and Ecce Homo, where Nietzsche is always doubled against himself. Autobiographies without an I is another structure are doomed to dullness, unless extraordinary things have happened to you. Adverb 3, vernacularly. I'm not even sure that's a word, vernacularly. That is, in the local spoken language, often by unlettered women. In the case of Julian, it probably meant that she didn't know Latin. She wasn't literatus. But other mystics, like Angela Foligno from the 13th century, were probably entirely illiterate and relied on Brother Scribe, a devoted monk. Julian's book is the first book in English by an Englishwoman. The same is true of Hardewijk of Antwerp in Middle Dutch, Marguerite Perret in Old French, Mechthild of Magdeburg in Middle Low German, and the sermons of Meister Eckhart in Middle High German. Medieval mysticism, especially in Northern Europe, is a discovery of the vernacular as a religious language. Of course, the use of the vernacular is an implicit challenge to the authority of the Catholic Church and its use of Latin. One can see this in England with John Wycliffe and the Lollards, and the rise of what is called Lollardy, and their insistence on the use of the translated Bible from the late 14th century onwards, which is linked to popular insurgency against the powers of church, king, and state, famously in the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. And one of the prime causes of that revolt was pandemic, the Black Death. Mysticism is often linked to what emerges in the Reformation in the early 16th century with Luther, who also translates the Bible. Luther is anti-mystical, committed to the alien nature of grace, and opposed the so-called enthusiasts of the Reformation, like Thomas Munzer and the Anabaptists, who are not a band, who stress the immanence of God in every person. The Reformation opens a different space for mysticism, which I would like to understand better in groups like the Quakers, the Shakers, the Baptists, and the Mormons, even all the way to Scientology. How to understand American mysticism. It's a messy, complex story, but a fascinating one for another time. Adverb 4, performatively. We can approach this issue by following Michel de Certeau, who is an interesting fellow, both a Jesuit priest and a psychoanalyst. For de Certeau, mysticism is not a domain of knowledge or a series of texts whose truth is evidence with reference to some exterior reality, like the reality of God, or simply authorized through an appeal to experience. On the contrary, for de Certeau, mysticism is a style, a set of practices, a way of speaking and acting that are self-authorizing. Mysticism is performative. It's a certain form of writing and speaking, which does not just record experience, but which produces experience. This experience might, for us, be unlived, but perhaps we're moved by it and seek to understand it, or we seek to imitate it in the mode of an exemplar. Mystical writing is a heterology where the presence of the speaker as subject is an effect of utterance made possible through the other speaking through the subject, where that other is usually God. I is an other is the basic mode of production for mystical texts. Mysticism is a heterology where God and the I become one, or, according to the great scholar of mysticism, Bernard McGinn, thinking of Meister Eckhart, where God and the I enter into a zone of indistinction. An indistinction between the I and God, which is premised on the annihilation of the soul. The activity of what Simone Weil called decreation. This is a beautiful and delicate thought that would take more time than I have in this talk to explain. Adverb 5, practically. The point about the performative dimension of mysticism can be put differently, and this is at the core of the scholar Amy Hollywood's approach to mysticism. She understands it in relation to religious practices, specifically the practices of reading, of scripture, preaching, prayer, and participation in liturgy, especially the recitation of the Psalms. In Hugh of St. Victor in the 12th century, the mystical life is linked to reading, meditation, prayer, composition, and contemplation. Lectio, meditatio, oratio, operatio, and contemplatio. That's a lot of O's. Importantly, these are both spiritual and physical practices. As Amy Hollywood writes of monasticism, the Benedictine's life is one in which the monk or nun strives to make every action a ritual action. Mysticism has to be understood in relation to the cultivation of such practices. Perhaps such practices are the best that we can hope to attain when the world has fallen to pieces. Another very simple way of putting this point is that mysticism is not some noetic or intellectual activity, or even some state of belief or non-belief, or even some theoretical apprehension of the divine. Rather, mysticism is a practical matter, a matter of organizing one's life around a set of practices. Mysticism is not a question of theoretical knowledge, or even about focusing on the interiority of the self. It is about doing, about the repetition of deeds, indeed of work and good works. It is about living according to a rule, however that might be understood. And this is the meaning of asceticism. Ascesis is sometimes translated into Latin as studium. Studium, which is both spiritual and bodily. This is what it means to study, to be a student, namely to become ascetic. If it ceases to mean that, then I do not know what study means. When one's life has become practically and performatively ritualized in accordance with a rule, mystical experience might occur. And here is a half-formed thought. We can also link the theme of practice to the origins of monasticism in St. Anthony and the Desert Fathers, who are also not a band. One of the most widely read books in the history of Christendom, much more widely read than Plato or Aristotle, was The Life of Anthony by Athanasius. And it itself was a kind of rewriting of Plato's Apology, where Socrates becomes Anthony, the philosopher becomes the monk. Anthony engages in a withdrawal or retreat from the city, in his case, Alexandria, which was the Manhattan of the ancient world, a commercial island city off the coast of a vast continent, set up by foreign colonial powers with a voracious appetite for everything. Anthony withdraws from the city, Alexandria, and goes first into the necropolis of the city, into the graveyard, and from there into the desert. Here, the desert is seen as a temple without walls. This is anachoresis, a retreat into solitude where the monk is the monos, the solitary. The idea here is that one can find God in the desert by withdrawing into a cave or into a cell. A cave is a cell. The desert is a kind of mystical laboratory where one can find God, a figure which is retained in changed form in the idea of the hermitage and the anchor hold. The point is that withdrawal is a practice. In the Desert Fathers, the fruit of withdrawal can be hesychia, quiet, stillness, silence, and the cultivation of apatheia, passionlessness or equanimity, disinterestedness, to become a corpse, dead to the world. And in doing this, one has to struggle with Acadia. Acadia, the noonday demon of listlessness and sloth, what we call depression. It's only through such Acadia that God could be felt, heard, and communicated with. It's only through dereliction and despair that one might engage in ekeptasis, the straining forward into God. It's only through listlessness that one might both listen to and lust for God. And both these senses of listening and lusting are present in the Middle English word list, L-I-S-T-E, which recurs in the cloud of unknowing. It's also there in Hamlet, Hamlet's list, list, O list. In place of the imprisoned philosopher, Socrates, we find the figure of the monk running to his prison cell. And remember the advice that the elderly desert monk gives to the doubting novice. Go to your cell, and your cell will teach you everything. Adverb 6, erotically. My interest in mysticism is a move towards what we can call a hystericization of philosophical discourse, as opposed to philosophy's typical anti-enthusiastic, anti-visionary, obsessional, neurotic rationalism. This can be better understood as transforming philosophy from the love of wisdom into the love of wisdom, or the wisdom of love. In order to list to God, we must both listen to and lust for the divine. On this point, the psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan is compelling. What is at stake for Lacan is the possibility of a lust, an enjoyment that is other than phallic. Other than phallic, what Lacan calls an other jouissance, a feminine enjoyment, something en plus, something he says more, something transgressive. It's fascinating that mystics place an emphasis upon the enjoyment of God. Marie of the Incarnation, a 17th century French missionary in Canada, wrote, "God alone was my only enjoyment." God is spiritually and physically enjoyed, which is why Christ is so important, why the incarnation is so vital. Christ is a sensuous being with a sensuous mother and a supersensuous father. And also why the Eucharist is so central to medieval mysticism. You get to eat God and drink his blood. God is orality. God is all mouth and enters into one's mouth with a kiss. This is where we would have to begin a reading of the most important text for Jewish and Christian mysticism, the Song of Songs. If this talk communicates nothing else than the following, then I'll be happy. Read and reread the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim. It's fascinating to me that the mystical tradition within Christianity, beginning at least as early as Origen in the 3rd century, particularly in Western Christianity, taking its lead from Bernard de Clairvaux, who writes 86 sermons on the topic between 1135 and 1153, reaching only verse 4 of chapter 3 of the Songs, that this tradition begins with an interpretation of the Song of Songs and continues as an ever-deepening, ever-widening commentary on these verses. Mysticism is here understood in the Song of Songs as spiritual betrothal, marriage of the soul and God, usually through Christ. Mysticism is a long nuptial song, hence the importance of this ancient Near Eastern Aramaic nuptial Song of Songs. So my interest in mysticism is also an interest in the relation of philosophy to sexual difference, by which I do not understand some essential distinction between man and woman, but a more complex map, a more complex topology of sex and gender, of behaviours and potentialities. Think of Julian of Norwich on the threefold maternity of Christ. For Julian, Christ, Jesus, is mother. Think of medieval images of the lactating Christ who feeds us with his breast or with the blood of his side wound. what Amy Hollywood calls that glorious slit. Or think of St. Francis with his open, porous, stigmatized body. Or think of the fiercely erotic connection that many mystics have to Christ, both female and male. To put it mildly, the gender of Christ is fluid, at once masculine and feminine, a most queer God. Mysticism is a tradition of affective piety, where the path of the Spirit opens through the body and where Christ is a transfigured mystical body, a material body, a spiritual body, and a political body. Adverb 7, the final adverb, ascetically. To my mind, mysticism is ascetic not despite its eroticism, but because of it. And this is a line of thinking that is puzzling for us. There is not a contradiction between eros and ascesis, between love or lust and denial or discipline. Rather, there's a relation of complementarity where the spiritual discipline permits the possible transfiguration of love, and it's love's transfiguration which is of ultimate importance. In connection with this, I'm curious about the meaningfulness of asceticism today. That is, both the forms of ascetic practice in which we engage, yoga, meditation, fasting, compulsive forms of routine following, which was particularly acute during the pandemic lockdown, or forms of ascetic practice which we pathologize, anorexia, bulimia, and so on. We are still quasi-ascetics, but purgation of sin for us has become a juice detox, and flagellation has become our relation to a bad selfie posted on social media. We find the extreme asceticism of mystical practice difficult to understand. Think of the extreme self-mortification of hermits and anchorites. And we're puzzled by the way in which mystical practice conceives of the relation between spirit and the flesh, mind and body. We have all apparently become holists or monists, where we are all body and body is all that there is. We're endlessly encouraged to listen to our body, let the body do the talking, let the body keep the score. This would be nice if it were true, but it isn't. We are not identical to our bodies, but rather our experience of ourselves is eccentric, divided from itself. Body holism is a new ideological discourse, which is refuted every time we get sick or sit in a dentist's chair or, even better, are plagued by hypochondriac symptoms. To be honest, I've had quite a lot of them over the last year, and I don't think I'm alone in this, but I'll spare you the tedious details. Mysticism is an attempt to describe another relation to the body, centered around some distinction between spirit and flesh, pneuma and sarkos. Mysticism is about the spiritualization of the flesh and the fleshly incarnate nature of the spirit, and to understand this requires a certain asceticism. We do not coincide with ourselves. Only psychopaths coincide with themselves. So with these seven adverbs, we can begin to approach the strange and compelling phenomenon that is mysticism, although we've barely even scratched the surface. At its core, at the core of mysticism, is love. Its meaning is love. What mysticism offers is an elevation and transfiguration of love. And this is experience at its most intensely lived. Listen to Julian of Norwich. This is from the last page of her showings. This is how she sums things up. And she's talking here about what was revealed to her, what was shown to her. She says, this is now Julian. And from the time that it was revealed, I desired many times to know in what was our Lord's meaning. And 15 years after and more, I was answered in spiritual understanding, and it was said, "What do you wish to know, your Lord's meaning in this thing? Know it well. Love was his meaning. Who reveals it to you? Love. What did he reveal to you? Love. Why does he reveal it to you? For love. Remain in this, and you will know more of the same. But you will never know different without end."
Thanks for listening to Subject, Object, Verb. If you enjoyed this lecture, I highly recommend reading Simon Critchley's new book and looking into his other activities, including the Necronautical Society, which has something to do with traveling into the space of death on a ship. Special thanks to Xenon Marco for his help with recording. And as always, feel free to drop us a message or a cry for help at subject object verb @artreview.com.